Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. So it's come to my attention, which basically means in English, I got a few emails telling me that some people don't like to listen to the whole song. Could I turn it down in the middle or fade it out? You know, I can't do it. I just can't do it. I cannot fade that song out. It's my favorite song in the whole world. It's a beautiful song. It's inspirational. It helps me get ready to do the radio show. It gets my thoughts together when I'm listening to it along with you. I hear it on my headphones, and I, you know, what can I tell you? So one person wrote to me and said that because of this seemingly endless theme song, he doesn't have the patience to stay tuned to the show. I don't know what to tell you. You might be missing a good radio show if that's the way you feel. I mean, I can understand. People are used to, you know, 30-second clips of music and little starts of this and spurts of that. But then here we have the opportunity to play an entire song. I know you've heard it a million times if you listen to the show. But each time I hear it, I love to hear it. And I've heard that from some other people, too. So I don't know what to tell you. Justice Brennan once said on a case, I don't know, about 30 or 40 years ago, a Supreme Court case involving the radio, if you don't like what's on there, that's what the dial is there for. These are old-fashioned radios. You can change the channel or turn it off. But, you know, I wish you'd stick around. So last week, there was this following article in the New York Times. It was last Monday. It says, Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. which is actually the name that they gave the city after they after the North Koreans and the Viet Cong and North Korean army won the Vietnam War. They changed Saigon to Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. Taking a puff from a hookah and a sip from her beer, Toi Trong, a 29-year-old tech entrepreneur in a black cocktail dress, pondered the question. What were her thoughts on the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon? 40 years ago, she yelled over the body-rattling roar of nightclub music. Who cares? Yeah, who cares? The Vietnam War, who cares? 4 decades after the victory of communist forces, the soul of this city, still known locally as Saigon, seems firmly planted in the present. For the young and increasingly affluent, Saigon is a city that does not want to look back, loves having fun, and perhaps most of all is voraciously capitalistic. So who won this war? The apartment building where evacuees clambered up an outdoor staircase to board a CIA helicopter in a chaotic rooftop operation, a scene captured in an iconic photograph, is now at the heart of a neighborhood filled with luxury shops selling $1,000 Rimowa suitcases and $2,000 Burberry suits. That's about $1,980 more than my shirt costs. But that's neither here nor there. A newly paved walkway runs down the median of a nearby Nguyen Huy Street, a magnet for teenagers on skateboards and inline skaters who swoosh past a temporary display of photographs honoring a deceased senior official of the Communist Party. A statue of Ho Chi Minh, the Communist Revolutionary leader, is sandwiched between a luxury hotel and a refurbished French colonial building that will soon house a Brooks Brothers store. Two-thirds of the Vietnamese population was born after the fall of Saigon and the reunification of Vietnam in 1975. Two-thirds. Among the young, there is a gratefulness that they are coming of age now when the country is at peace after so many centuries of wars, occupations, and entanglements with foreign armies. Quote, I feel lucky that I was born a long time after 1975, said Thuy Nghi, who at 22 has her own company that buys, refurbishes, and sells homes. Developer. From a childhood of poverty and misfortune, Ms. Thuy Nghi parlayed a small trading company into a thriving business and now owns 4 cars and numerous houses. That's probably even as much as John McCain, who doesn't even know how much he owns. But she owns now, you know, she was born in poverty and she worked hard and at the age of 22 owns 4 cars and numerous houses. In the early years of a unified Vietnam, the government pursued disastrous experiments with collectivized farms and bans on private enterprise. The country's leaders changed course around the time the Soviet Union collapsed, embracing the market economy, a pillar of the very system they had fought to defeat. Since then, Saigon, a free-willing bastion of capitalism before 1975, has returned to its roots with vigor. And we remember its roots before 1975. Bribery, corruption, brutality, etc. Ralph Mathias, a Canadian who arrived in Vietnam in 1993, remembers streets filled with nothing but bicycles. If you saw a car, you would actually stop and stare at it, he said. Motorcycles have taken over the city streets now, and often the sidewalks. The roar of so many internal combustion engines in unison is the hallmark of a modern Vietnamese city. Yes, don't I know about the roar of internal combustion engines? You're going to be running the gauntlet of them in Manhattan just to even get here. Okay, so now in Saigon, the roar of so many internal combustion engines in unison is the hallmark of a modern Vietnamese city. Good for them. And sounds like a giant wave crashing and rolling onto the shore. If for the Americans, the war here, in which 58,000 Americans and as many as 3 million Vietnamese died, was on some level about keeping Vietnam safe for capitalism, it turns out that they need not have worried. Capitalism here churns relentlessly. aided by what Ted Osius, the United States ambassador, calls the most entrepreneurial people on earth. City planners here speak approvingly of the intense competition and constant cycle of corporate failure and rebirth. The shell of a communist command economy still remains. The state-owned companies that make up around one quarter of the economy have large debts and are not very efficient, not like the capitalist companies. The private sector and foreign companies are what keep the economy buzzing. Rags-to-riches stories are everywhere. Ms. Toi Trung, the tech entrepreneur, does not have electricity in her home until she was seven. She now develops smartphone apps and commutes between Mountain View, California, and Ho Chi Minh City. She recently sold her software firm to Weeby, an American company, for more than $1 million. She turns 30 in December. Nguyen Trung Tin, 28, took over his parents' real estate company last year. He remembers his parents' relentless struggle to turn nothing into a sizable fortune, with them studying Chinese, Japanese, and Russian language tapes well into the night in a one-room apartment they shared when he was a boy. Now Mr. Tin is in the thick of the glamour of the new Vietnam. He owns two nightclubs, an events company, and a Thai restaurant. But he criticizes many of his generation for forsaking what had been a culture of self-improvement for a culture of materialism for its own sake. You know, welcome to capitalism. What do they think? They see the fast cars. They have Louis Vuitton bags and Christian Louboutin shoes, he said. For them, it's just a question of how do I get that? They are hungry for the wrong reasons and for the wrong things. The easy money was made more than a decade ago when property prices soared and millionaires were minted overnight. It now, in this capitalist society of Vietnam, takes a lot of hard work, luck, and often government connections to make a fortune. Does that sound familiar? That's entertainment. That's capitalism. So it's it's a strange thing. Actually, what's interesting is I was playing Scrabble with somebody the day before, and we pulled a dictionary, yes, an old-fashioned dictionary, out of the bookcase because we didn't feel like going over to the computer to look up a word. Imagine that. And when we put the tried to put the dictionary back, it wouldn't go back in. And it turns out that what was keeping the dictionary from sliding back into the bookcase was an old book. It was a small paperback book, an old paperback book wrapped in plastic. And I immediately recognized one of the books. There's a few books left over from when I was in the old book business for decades. And this was one of those books. And I looked through the plastic wrapping, and it was 1,001 Ways to Beat the Draft. Is that 1,001 Ways to Beat the Draft from 1967? One of the authors was Thule Kupferberg, which probably only people who were around then and a very small group of people who listened to BAI or who were in the anti-war movement would even know who he was. He was a yippie. He was a hippie and a political activist from the 60s. But 1,001 Ways to Beat the Draft. I mean, it brought back. Oh, by the way, I don't know if this is real or not, but you know how some people write their names on the inside cover of a book on the title page or on the facing page to the title page and say, this is my book, so-and-so. John Smith, you know, my book. There's a name written in pen on the cover of this book, 1,001 Ways to Beat the Draft, because I unwrapped the plastic to look at it. And it's William Clinton. In fact, it's William. And it looked like I couldn't tell if the middle initial was J or T, but it's William Clinton. Could it be that this was Bill Clinton's copy of 1,001 Ways to Beat the Draft? What happened with Clinton in Vietnam? I don't think he was drafted or served in Vietnam. I know that. So I don't know. Maybe this is his copy. If it turns out that it is his copy, I'm going to sell it. And that's if they don't kill me for owning. If they find out I own it, maybe I shouldn't even make a public declaration about that. But it's too late. But to see this book, 1001 Ways to Beat the Draft, and then the next day I read this article, and this woman is saying, what happened 40 years ago? The 40th anniversary, rather, of the fall of Saigon. 40 years ago, she says, who cares? So the question that you might want to ask is, what was that war about? Why was that war at all? What was the war about? What was all that discord and violence and suffering and death all about? I mean, really, as far as she's concerned, who cares? Yeah, 1001 Ways to Beat the Draft. 1001 Ways to Beat the Draft. And now, is this entirely, it might be entirely generational, I guess it is, you know, that this brings back so many memories to me because this is the baby boomers, one of which I am, I guess, booming, you know, not booming so loud anymore, but the baby boomers. This is our one of the defining moments of our generation. You know, like for my parents' generation, and I'm talking about people who were born, let's say, from 1915 to through the 1920s and 30s, it was a depression in World War II, which is every generation seems to have some major defining moments. I guess for my son, who's 30 years old, it would be, I mean, he was in high school, it would be 9/11 and everything that's happened after that. So there are defining moments of generations that change everything and that define your youth. They are, when you think back on your youth, you automatically think back on this. So 1001 Ways to Beat the Draft. And then we find out that in Saigon, which was the scene of so much carnage and corruption and misery and depravity and, you know, where eventually, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of American troops involved in this absurd, immoral, ridiculous, brutal war passed through, now called Ho Chi Minh City, is a thriving bastion of capitalism, a thriving bastion of capitalism, a kind of a like a even a New York's New York. And you just have to wonder. Now, what there's some history involved here, obviously. You know, I mean, we're talking about the war in Vietnam. And if you flash back, I mean, for the and what about it's interesting this article didn't mention it mentioned all the entrepreneurs and somebody owns four houses and four cars. It didn't mention whether there's which is inevitable with out-of-control capitalism like we have in this country. It didn't mention income inequality and awful poverty and the fact that sooner or later they may not even be in middle class, or maybe there is hardly a middle class there now. For all I know, it is the rich and the poor, and maybe no real middle class, just like in this country. But the war in Vietnam, and Vietnam had been fighting this war. I mean, did they teach history? They don't teach much history in this country anymore. I wonder if they teach history in Vietnam, teach the history of Vietnam. But these people don't care. They don't want to know about it. Well, who could blame them? A lot of these people who are in their late 20s or early 30s, they grew up poor. They grew up poor, and they worked hard and made their money, which they couldn't have done in a completely communist society, but they can do in a capitalist society. So these things are not absolutely simple. But then the excesses of capitalism, obvious in this country, are becoming kind of obvious there. So interestingly enough, the article did not mention poverty in Saigon or poverty in Vietnam. And it's inevitable that capitalism creates a kind of, you know, extreme upper class and a vast lower class. The workers and people who are unemployed. But Vietnam, and to the Vietnamese, the Vietnamese of my age, the people who were subjected to all this misery and violence and murder and death, and the people who were in the Viet Cong, the people who were in the North Vietnamese Army, it's all one unified country now. I wonder what they think of this article. I wonder what they think of the fact that they fought so hard against the capitalist gigantic titan, the United States of America, and they were fighting in the name of at least Ho Chi Minh, who was their leader. They were fighting in the name of socialism, at least, and if not actual communism, and they were fighting against this kind of combination of military-industrial state that the United States was, is capitalism. So I wonder what it. I wonder what this an article like this means to them. What do they think of all this? Maybe they're happy. Maybe they're happy that they could finally be left in peace, and maybe their children are supporting them in a way they never could have been supported in any kind of system, right? So maybe they're just happy about it. But maybe they also feel the same way. Sort of like, what was it all about? What was all that incredible suffering, and that fighting, and losing all your relatives, whole towns burned to the ground, brutality and murder created on a mass scale by the American forces, you know, the Air Forces and the Marines and the Army, and just astounding. And then what they had to sacrifice to kick these people out of their country. And the Vietnamese have been fighting for 1,000 years. They've been fighting for 1,000 years. And now this is the first time, as the article mentions, that they have a country that is free of having to fight some invader or some large force from the outside that wants to take over and own their country. I mean, for hundreds of years, off and on probably for 1,000 or more years, it was in a unified country then, but Vietnam, the people in Vietnam, had to fight the Chinese, who were right on their border, still are on their border. And eventually, maybe they'll have to deal with the Chinese again. The Chinese are expanding all over the place. Talk about capitalist economies, capitalist monsters. the Chinese are outdoing the Americans, or they're catching up and are looking like they're going to outdo the Americans when it comes to being the world's leading capitalist country. So they fought the Chinese for like 1,000 years or whatever to try to keep their their tribal ways and their culture and their country intact and to protect their resources, which essentially were rice. The Chinese always wanted more rice because there was always starvation and famine, and they may have wanted some of the other resources that that were in Vietnam. Then, you know, after the Chinese, then in the colonial period in the 19th century and later on, it was the French. When the French and the British and the Dutch and the Portuguese and the Spanish were grabbing whole parts of the globe and enslaving people or treating people like serfs everywhere and like slaves and sometimes literally like slaves, the French took over what was then called Annam, and now it's called Vietnam, later on Vietnam. So the French took over. Then later on in the 30s and through the 40s, it was the Japanese. And then after the Japanese were defeated in World War II, and this is, you know, that's what these people have lived through. I mean, there's few countries in the world that have lived through so much occupation and ill treatment and bad times as this country, as these people have. And after the Japanese were defeated, the French moved in again. But by then, the North Vietnamese government, there was in 1954, I think it was, there was an accord reached, and Vietnam was divided into two separate countries, North Vietnam and South Vietnam. And that's when the real civil war began. And that's when the North, under Ho Chi Minh and creating a guerrilla force, the Viet Cong, made their plans to overthrow the French, get rid of them, and reclaim their own country for themselves. Just for once. I think I'll have a little water here, if you don't mind. So, and then the French, you know, the French couldn't deal with the with the North Vietnamese. They couldn't deal with the Viet Cong, but they especially couldn't deal with the North Vietnamese. And the North Vietnamese, they whipped the French. They beat them. This is the French was fighting to save its colonial empire in Algeria, where they lost eventually. And a couple of other places, and also in Vietnam, where they were as brutal as they could possibly be, torturing people to get information from them. The French were awful when it came to treating their opponents in any kind of civil war, any kind of uprising or guerrilla war, like any colonial power would be. And they were terrible. And finally, the North Vietnamese defeated them out of just pure willpower, sort of the moral rightness of their cause, and just military strategy. They were just better at fighting the French than the French were at fighting. And they thought, okay, now we're getting rid of the French, and that'll be that. We finally, after all this time with all these invaders and all these occupiers, we'll finally have our own country back. And what happens? The United States government comes in. In the middle of, the Eisenhower administration, and takes over for the French, and this is under the leadership of the Dulles brothers, and American military-industrial complex, this power struggle that went on with communism and capitalism, went on with the United States and Russia basically after World War II. And Vietnam was one of these places. So the Americans replaced the French, and little by little by little, they sent in the CIA, then they sent in CIA operatives, and all this sound, I'm sure, could sound very familiar, right? Mercenary CIA operatives who were paramilitary. Then they hired people. And then you had, of course, you know, North and South Vietnam were separate governments. Well, the South Vietnamese government was as brutal and corrupt as it could possibly be, and it was run by a succession of, well, you know, I don't know, hereditary monarchies and by generals, and all of them basically employed by the Americans and the French. And their police forces and their army didn't have any more belief in freedom or freedom of speech. Or, I mean, it was like basically living under a dictatorship for the Vietnamese in the South. In the North, the communists took over and imposed their own kind of order and their own kind of dictatorship. But it was their country, at least. It was at least their country. They weren't being backed by anybody. The Russians did help them out, but not all that much. It was really their revolution. And Ho Chi Minh was their inspiration. He was their leader. He had been a student in Moscow. He had studied there. He had experienced all kinds of misery and trouble, you know, growing up in Vietnam when he was young. And then later he went and studied in Moscow. And he was a real revolutionary, became a communist. Originally, actually, he admired the United States. He admired the United States. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Ho Chi Minh, who was the leader of North Vietnam, was a big admirer of the United States until they showed up to try to take over from the French and destroy the actual real revolution. I mean, we had a revolution here, right? But they're not allowed to have theirs. It was okay for us to have a revolution, but other countries couldn't have their revolutions. Why? Because the commies were behind them. The Russians were behind them. Because it was a system. The devil system, communism, right? And it was just, these were the days, the 50s and left over into the 60s of the Americans and the Russians fighting the Cold War. And they fought it, and the whole world was a chessboard for them. You know, Cuba with, you know, the missiles in the 1960s and many other countries, the Congo, countries all over the world. And Vietnam was one of them. Vietnam was one of them. And the American government kept backing, basically after the French, you know, were running the South Vietnamese government, the Americans took over the government of South Vietnam. I mean, they just used money and power and troops, and they just took over the government. And it was a succession of brutal, sometimes crazy, militant, dictatorial leaders in South Vietnam. And this is just a bit of history here. So basically what you had in Vietnam was a civil war. It was a real civil war. It was a revolution from up north and employing, you know, guerrilla troops called the Viet Cong. And they had their own North Vietnamese army. And it was a civil war in which they wanted to overthrow the American-backed, first French, then American-backed South Vietnamese government, and have the whole country be united and be just for the Vietnamese, even if it was under a communist system. So it was a revolution and essentially a civil war. And that we got involved in it, that the United States of America got involved in it, is a shame. Is a terrible shame because we had no business being involved in it. And it was a war, really, that was fought not for resources. This is not a country that has oil and gold, and not that I've read recently, that has oil or gold or diamonds or uranium or anything like that. I mean, they had, rubber plantations, rice, vast production of rice, and, you know, maybe some other resources. Maybe I'm displaying my ignorance, but no major resources that the rest of the world tends to fight over all the time. This was a war of almost where the Dulles brothers and the right wing, the conservatives in this country, the rich in this country, were fighting this war as a kind of an ideological war. It was a sort of power, like I say, global chess with the Russians, and it was like a religious war, and the religions were capitalism and communism. That's the way people saw it. That's the way people in this country saw it, and I don't know how the Russians saw it, but they may have seen it that way too. I think they were more cynical. It was about power and a kind of crazy ideology, and as I say, for the Vietnamese, they would take whatever they could, use whoever they wanted, and take whatever they could get to try to reclaim their own country, to have a revolution. So, and then it turned into a bigger and bigger war. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson, and this has happened many times with the United States and other countries too, and the Germans did this right before World War II, they set up a phony attack by the North Vietnamese. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson claimed that he announced to everybody, to the whole world and to the country, that a United States, I think it was a destroyer or some United States naval vessel, was attacked in the Gulf of whatever it was, North Vietnam, Gulf of Tonkin, which is near North Vietnam. And, of course, there's no reason why that American destroyer should have been there in the first place. We had no business being there. Like, we had no business being in half the places in the world that we were and still are, only just to exert our power. Now, although things are more complicated now because we're dealing with that kind of crazy religious terrorism, but that's not what the case was here. Here, we were just imposing our might and our power and our ideas on these people. So we have... We're provoking them all the time. So some American naval vessel was a few miles off the coast of North Vietnam. And Lyndon Johnson claims that a couple of North Vietnamese patrol boats came out and fired, missiles, or torpedoes at these American naval vessel. Well, this is outrageous. How dare they? The vicious commies, how dare they attack the red, white, and blue? I mean, the absurdity and the nuttiness of this. I mean, it was all just a setup, right? So after that, troops were sent in. There were already troops and CIA officers and paramilitary people, and there were already American Special Forces advisors there. What's new, right? This is the same thing we hear all the time. But then actual Marines were sent in. Then the Army was sent in, then the Air Force started, and eventually we got deeper and deeper and deeper into it until it became something like, at the ultimate, it was 500,000 American military personnel were in this country halfway around, on the other side of the world, in this country where people were just merely trying to fight for their own country. They were having their own revolution like we once had, to try to have their own place that they could call their own. That they were communists, so what? Well, good for them, Who cares? Who cares? They weren't interested in expanding, and they still haven't. They haven't invaded any other country. They weren't looking to get their country consolidated like a caliphate. This is not like ISIS wants to do. It wants to spread all over the Middle East and eventually all over the world and control everything. This is not like the Nazis or the Russians or the Americans even. They didn't want an empire, just wanted their own country. So there they are. Now they have to deal with us after they get rid of the French, after the Japanese, after the French before them, after the Chinese. I mean, there's just no end to it for these people, and it was just too much for them. But they had great military strategists, and they had an inspirational leader and wise inspirational leader in Ho Chi Minh. And they commit excesses? Yes, they did. They committed excesses. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong could be just as brutal as anybody, right? If people were not going along with the revolution, if people, God help the people in the middle. It's always the people in the middle, right? There were a lot of people who sympathized with them. They wanted to get rid of the outside invaders and the oppressors. But usually it's just all these people, mostly farmers. Some people lived in the cities, yes, but then it was a country of farmers, and they lived in the middle and would rather not have been bothered by anybody. But this is what happens when, a lot of people, mostly in an agrarian society, get caught in between, or I suppose even in, a modern society, get caught in between crazy, passionate, domineering, megalomaniac forces who want to take over everything. You could actually just tell me. It's because I can't understand the sign language. 20 minutes. Thank you very much. We're still working this out. We're going to use fires and blankets, and we're going to do smoke signals. I think we'll do that next. I think the studio should be all right. We could set a small fire in the studio. So this is what's going on, right? And nobody is saying that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were angels. They could be just as brutal as anybody, right? But it was the Americans who got in there, and there was something about them being there. They didn't belong there. And I think a lot of the Americans who fought there knew in their hearts, even the ones who joined up to be patriotic. I mean, after all, a lot of the Americans, my generation, who fought there were inspired by their father's bravery and courage and fighting in World War II against the Japs, the Japanese Empire, the brutal Japanese, and, of course, the Nazis. And this was my generation. The boys were brought up to believe in the red, white, and blue. You know, you put your hand over your heart at the baseball game, and you have hot dogs, and you see the flag wave, and Memorial Day, and it was all World War II. And it was the good war. It was the right war. And we were fighting evil empires and dictators who really did, you know, cause, you know, tens and tens of millions of deaths, right? And so this is who we were inspired by. This is what war meant to us. And a lot of people joined up, but a lot more people were drafted. I think there was an essential understanding during Vietnam in this country by a lot of people. And it didn't take a lot of information. I mean, you know, usually the propaganda came from the government and from the newspapers, all the, you know, the New York Times, as usual, all the TV stations and the government, of course, you know, Lyndon Johnson and all these people talking about how the evil communists were taking over Vietnam. The Russians were behind them, and they would murder everybody. They were going to kill all the priests, and they were going to murder everybody, and they were going to destroy people's freedom of speech and everything else. Yeah, well, it's a communist government. Maybe they would have. I don't know. But this is what they're preaching to us, and we have to save the Vietnamese from these people. We have to save the Vietnamese from these evil people who just happen to be Vietnamese. No talk about our empire, about fighting the Russians, about using these people as pawns, and certainly no talk about how we were going to save them. And there was a kind of a civil war in this country, too. While there was a civil war in Vietnam, there was a civil war in the United States, too. What I mean by that is that there was a draft instituted. The draft was, I guess draft was always in place. But this is the first time since World War II and maybe during Korea where the draft was, expanded or instituted, whatever the word for it is. And, millions of American boys the age of, you know, over 18 received draft cards. And, or was it 21? Sometimes I get that wrong. Anyhow, millions of American boys received draft cards. And there was a lottery. There was a certain number, high, low. And many people were drafted into this war. If, in fact, this was the genius of Nixon after Vietnam, that they got rid of the draft and instituted a professional army so that the president can send this army all over the world anytime they want, he wants or she wants, eventually maybe. And the voters have nothing to say about it. The citizens of this country have nothing to say about it. But then it was a draft. And people didn't want, a lot of people sort of in their guts understood that, especially they were drafting a lot of black people, right? A lot of poverty-stricken black people, a lot of blacks who, sympathized with these people. These were downtrodden people, beaten down, being murdered by the white powers that be in this country. And they didn't want to be drafted. I mean, very few people really volunteered for this war. Most people were drafted because I think, and I get back to what I was saying originally, that people felt in their gut, they looked at the map, they'd never heard of these people, they didn't see these people, expanding all over the place, they didn't see these people as Nazis or the Japanese Empire or any empire at all. They just saw these people as living in some faraway place, which was fields and mountains and jungles and cities, and it was their own country. Why are we going there, people thought to themselves. But people got drafted anyhow. They got drafted in their hundreds of thousands. Hundreds of thousands of people were drafted and fought in Vietnam. Millions of people were drafted, but hundreds of thousands fought in Vietnam. And as far as I was concerned, like I said, there was a civil war in this country. The people of my father's generation, even people who had been, who in other ways were very liberal and understanding, who believed in, fighting for civil rights and everything else, still had this old-fashioned notion of what war was. We were fighting the evil empire, the Russians, and believing they were an evil empire, just like we were and still are, and just like the Russians still are. We had fought the Nazis before the Japanese Empire. We fought the Russians eventually in the Cold War. So this was just an extension of that. So what happened was people in my father's generation and a lot of other people who really didn't understand what was going on over there, the people who were always waving the flag and calling everybody else a communist. And, you know, it was a time of revolution and hippiedom. So if you had long hair and you were against the war, you were a commie. Hippies were commies, right? You were a traitor. Same thing as now, right? If you don't believe in any war that this country is fighting, you're traitors. If you go out and you demonstrate against the war, you're a traitor. And they go so far now as to have the NSA investigate you to find out whether or not you're even using keystrokes on your keyboard to support the whatever the evil empire is these days. So there was a civil war. People had violent arguments. People didn't talk to each other for years on end. Fathers and sons had violent, violent arguments against, with each other. And I was called in twice. I had a draft card, and I was called in twice for testing to see whether or not I'd be going into the Army. And eventually into combat. I wasn't going to join, that's for sure, because I was going to anti-war rallies on the campus where I went to school, 1965 and 66, when the war was really getting going. I was the president of the Young Democrats, and I was an extremely liberal person in those days. And I set up on our campus, which was in a very conservative place, Nassau County out in Long Island, in New York State, one of the most conservative counties in the country, I set up a table with anti-war material on it. And the local, the campus ROTC colonel, who was a thick-necked sort of redneck senior and was in charge of the ROTC there, he came over with a bunch of his guys, knocked the table over, spit on us. We're commies, we're traitors, we're hippies. And this was what's going on. The whole country was torn apart here with violent, violent arguments, and the police were beating up people who were holding rallies, and a lot of construction workers and people who felt that we were traitors to the country by opposing a war. Anybody who opposed a war of the United States was inherently a traitor. Just sort of seems like now, too. And there were, violent encounters in which a lot of people got beat up. Draft cards were burned. Military installations were infiltrated by people who were pacifists, and things were set on fire. Bombs were set off by people who weren't such pacifists. At recruiting stations, it was a really awful time. And this is what my generation remembers. And I was called in twice. Once I was given a 1Y, which is a one-year deferment. I think it's because I was still a senior in college, so I got a student deferment. The next time I was called in to Whitehall Street downtown in Manhattan, and famous in my generation. One of those. Every city has its military recruiting station where they call people in to test you. And they gave us an IQ test, they gave us hearing tests, they gave us reflex testing, they gave us eye tests, they gave us all kinds of tests to find out if we were able to serve in the armed forces. And, people dreaded this, and they would go to so much trouble. People would take pills to make themselves sick. People were in dread. Most people didn't want to go there. They didn't want to be drafted into the Army. They wanted to live their lives. It was a time of rock and roll and freedom and trying to celebrate life, not to go halfway around the world and kill a bunch of people who were just trying to have their own country. I mean, this was absurd. So people dreaded these things. You had to go in, because you didn't, they'd arrest you. They would lock you up if you avoided the draft. Some people went to Canada and stayed there for years. Some people went underground and hid. Nobody could find them, but you were violating federal law when you did this. And they called me into Whitehall Street along, this happened to hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands at least, of other people. And I went in and deliberately answered everything on the IQ test where they asked me what something was, I would answer wrong. So they made me take the test over again because it turned out I had, like, according to the test and the way I took it, I had like a 12 IQ. Because everything, I knew that was right, I answered it in the wrong way. And everybody was doing this. And it was so absurd that that they made you take it over again and you know, take it until you pass the IQ level for being a combat soldier, which was probably 82 or something like that. And then they gave me a hearing test. And they said, when you hear a beep, press a buzzer. Every time I didn't hear a beep, I pressed a buzzer. When I heard a beep, I didn't, you know, I did press the buzzer. When I heard a beep, I left the buzzer alone. When I heard silence, I pressed the buzzer. So when I got out of the room, I was walking down the hallway, and some sergeant, there was a whole bunch of sergeants, most of them from the South, they had Southern accents, comes up behind me and says, "Yo!" like this. And I jumped. He says, "I guess you're not deaf because your hearing test shows you're deaf." And on and on and on. Everybody tried whatever they could do in a frantic effort to avoid the draft. Eventually, I did avoid the draft and was 4F because I had a letter from my psychologist who I was seeing at the time, the latest psychologist in what would turn out to be an endless parade of them. And he wrote that in his professional opinion that it would be a bad idea to have me join the armed forces, to have me in the armed forces, because if I was given a weapon, there was no telling who I was going to point it at and shoot. And that seemed to make enough of an impression. So I was interviewed by the psychiatrist, the Army psychiatrist, and they were taking everybody. There were people there who brought letters and similar letters, and they weren't being believed, and they were sent straight into. You went straight into the Army from there, right? Do not say go, right? You went straight into the Army from there. And people were scared to death. There was one guy in front of me who was dressed completely as a woman. He had lipstick on. He had, you know, he was just completely as a transvestite, lipstick and everything else. And I said to this guy, I'm whispering, you know, because he's standing in line. I said, "Is this for real? I mean, are you really?" And he says, "No, man, but I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go. If they think I'm a transvestite, they're not going to send me." They sent him. Somehow they figured out that he wasn't, and they sent him into the Army. And there were people crying there. It was really something, and people were yelling. My father and I had really terrible arguments about this, terrible arguments, in which he said that, you know, I was basically a communist, which is absurd, a communist. I'm out there in Queens, you know, working for the welfare department. I don't think I was a communist. and I said, "You're a capitalist pig." My father, the capitalist pig, right? This went on all over the country. It was a terrible time. And and like I say, it was, the people who went over, I have friends who went over to Vietnam, and I have some relations who went over to Vietnam. And a lot of people who listen to me now on the radio, who write to me regularly, went to Vietnam. They were in combat. They got drafted. I think a couple of them maybe joined. They were urged to join by their fathers who had been in World War II, and then said it was their patriotic duty to join. A lot of people I know came back from there permanently deranged and disabled in their minds, if not actually crippled in some way or hurt physically, so they could never be the same again. It was an awful, awful thing. And sometimes I felt guilty and still feel guilty that I went to so much trouble to get out of the draft and out of the Army when other people who couldn't afford to, and a lot of black, this is white middle class, a lot of white middle class people were able to figure out a way to get out, whereas a lot of black people had no chance whatsoever. They got sent straight there. And one of the things was that when I was a probation officer, as an alternative to being sentenced to misdemeanors and to minor felonies, they would say, "You can walk down to the recruiting office right over here. The court officer will take you, and you can go straight to Vietnam, or I'll put you in jail." This is the choice that a lot of black guys were given. And they didn't have the connections or the ability or the money. And this is not a new thing in the history of wars and the draft and everything in this country, to get out. So it was an awful, awful time. And like I say, this went on for many, many years and affected millions of people in one way or another. And it was one of the defining moments of our generation. And now you look at an article like this with all the capitalism, you know, rampant over there. Like I say, they don't mention anything about poverty. Is there poverty? Is there income inequality? It has to be. It has to be absolutely inevitable, and it will only get worse over there, just like it does here. This is what happens when materialism and capitalism is completely out of control. Am I a communist? I don't think so. But I wouldn't mind if the country was a socialist country. And there's plenty of good examples of publicly owned corporations that do very well here in this country, especially power corporations. I read an article in the Times the other day that 25% of the power in this country are owned by the states and the localities and the cities and towns where they operate. They're not owned by private companies. So it's possible. It's possible to have that. But when you read this, when you read this article, you wonder, did we win? We lost the war. The Viet Cong and North Vietnamese kicked our asses, no matter what we had. The overwhelming power and the way we blanketed that place with chemicals and destroyed everything and just murdered everything in sight, shot everything we could see. We lost the war. And I think one of the reasons we lost the war is because people's hearts weren't in it. And because we knew, or maybe the people who went over there, they fought as hard as they could, I suppose, and fought for their buddies, but they knew they were in the wrong place fighting the wrong war. It was an immoral war. In World War II, they used to have to save gasoline. There were signs on the highway that said, is this trip really necessary? And you have to ask yourself here, was this war really necessary? I mean, there's all kinds of wars. There's Korean War, Afghanistan, Iraq, now ISIS. I'm not a total pacifist. I am not a total pacifist. But when you think of Vietnam and you look at this article and you think of Vietnam, it was, in fact, one of, if not one of the, not the defining moment for a lot of people in my generation. The defining moment. But it was immoral. It was immoral then. And what now? Is it meaningless? All this trouble, all this discord, all this PTSD, all this stuff that affected us, is it utterly meaningless? What was it all worth in the end?
Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Woo-hoo, all gone. Come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. I man, this is war, a go-go. There's plenty of good money to be made. Supplying the army with the tools of the trade. Just hope and pray that if they drop the bomb, we're dropping on a Viet Cong. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, wonder why. Woo-hoo, all gonna die. Now come on, generals, let's move fast. Your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, cause the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when you're blowing them all the kingdom come. Sing it! One, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Louder! People, I don't know how you expect to ever stop the war if you can't sing any better than that. There's about 300,000 of you fuckers out there. I want you to start singing. Come on. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, I ain't no time to wonder why. We're all gonna die. Now come on, mother, it's about to
Volume, please.